Gone with the Wind in Puerto Rico, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. San Juan Mayor Carmen Julin Cruz has been the face of Puerto Rico's recovery efforts after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. She's openly sparred with President Trump and with the head of FEMA over the U.S. government's aid efforts, and she doesn't care.
Frankly, last scene of Gone with the Wind, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Plus, North Korea's new vice director of propaganda and agitation has a familiar surname.
Kim Yo-jong's position has been achieved due to the fact that she is a sister to Kim Jong-un.
And the tradition of getting inked in India.
You know, in my family, it was essential, it was necessary the moment you got married to have a tattoo.
But that is changing. It's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with us today here on The World. It is day 19 without electricity on most of Puerto Rico. When I say most, I mean nearly 90% of the island. That's what we're hearing. We're going to start the show today with perhaps the most public face of the island's struggle to get back to normal after Hurricane Maria, the worst storm to hit the island in nearly a century. Carmen Julin Cruz is the mayor of San Juan, the capital. She has publicly confronted FEMA, exchanged heated words on social media with President Trump, and said not providing better assistance could be tantamount to a, quote, genocide. Correspondent Jasmine Garz and producer Andrea Crossan report for our Cross Women's Lives desk. And they spent an afternoon with Mayor Julin as she visited several devastated areas in the city of San Juan. They started off in the working-class neighborhood of Caimito, where many have not had power or even enough food and water since the storm hit. Jasmine Garz joins us now. Jazz, how are you?
Hi, Marco. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here, and good to have you back. So as you survey these neighborhoods, you got a chance to speak one-on-one with the mayor. What were some of her most pressing concerns?
Yeah, I think right now her most pressing concerns are just basic needs, you know, people not getting water, people not getting food, people not getting medicine, people living in houses that could still collapse. She also emphasized that certain populations are a lot more vulnerable. Remember, Puerto Rico has an undocumented population from neighboring islands that has little access to official assistance. And there's a lot of older people who are suffering through severe heat without having electricity to keep them cool or their medications cool. And Mayor Cruz emphasized the greater impact the crisis was going to have on women and children.
It is the women that carry the burden of the homes and carry the burden of taking care of the sick, the elderly, those with special needs. And then just think now it's going to be compounded when they have to go to work, because where will their children stay? Yes, definitely. It is women that are hit the hardest.
Jazz, FEMA has criticized Mayor Cruz there for her complaints, and President Trump famously made a reference to her as nasty on Twitter. How does she feel about being under this intense spotlight?
Yeah, well, Marco, that's one of the first things I asked her, and I will let her answer for herself.
I don't give a shit, because this isn't about me or politics. That's why I'm very content to have churches, private organizations go into our Coliseo Roberto Clemente, picking up our, what we call our hope boxes, and handing them out. I'm not the face that you're going to see out there just giving you a box of food for the photo op. You know, I'm the face that has to make sure that somebody gets that to you. So, frankly, last scene of Gone with the Wind, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Wow. So, Jazz, did you get a sense of what the political fallout for the mayor could be from all this? Will there be any?
Yeah, it's clear that there will be consequences. You know, I think for any politician, how they respond to a catastrophe can make or break their career. If the mayor responds to this tragedy in an efficient manner, she is going to be very well positioned to run for governor. And there's rumblings of that on the island. She's adored by many for her proactive and aggressive stance. And it's interesting, she has in the past advocated for Puerto Rico to have a more independent role in relation to the United States. You know, Marco, the other point that she made is that there is going to be an impact on the mainland. There already is an exodus of Puerto Ricans to the mainland, to the U.S., and it's inevitable that now there's going to be a massive exodus. We spoke to young people who told us, you know, I'm suddenly out of a job, or I was told not to come back to work until next year. So it's a safe bet that a lot of those people are going to leave. And Puerto Ricans tend to vote Democrat. Wherever they land, they're going to affect the political landscape. Here is what the mayor had to say about that.
Wherever Puerto Ricans land, that's going to change. Where are they going to go? Florida, right? And how are they going to vote? Mostly Democrat. So if I was Mr. Trump, I would want things to get here very quickly, because in the last two elections, the electoral map has come down to Florida.
You know, we've had several people write in and said they distrusted the mayor's motives and felt a lot of this was for show, for political gain. So here she is getting in the media spotlight with a strong belief that she's positioning herself to run for governor of Puerto Rico. Is that too cynical?
You know, I think what people like about the mayor is that she spoke and she continues to speak truth to power. She shows a lot of emotion, in really in stark contrast with a very elite local government that is seen as completely out of touch and a federal government that is perceived as completely disinterested. I mean, having said that, she took us on these visits and there was a showboaty, ham-handed element. You know, they're very staged. She's hugging people and crying as a perimeter of invited journalists stand around and watch. Here she is giving a solar lamp to one of the residents.
Mira, Diego, dame una aquí. Mira, le vamos a dar una lamparita. Esto es solar. Solar. Así es que ellos son de Operación Bendición.
Yeah, you can hear her really kind of making the point that she's one of the people there.
Yeah, so there was an element of political show. And I think, listen, I think American media has a huge crush on her. And here's the larger point. The people we visited on this evening that we spent with Mayor Yulín Cruz, they were already living in abject poverty long before the hurricane, okay? They were living in what can only be described as squalor during a time in which she was the mayor of the city for about 5 years. And I asked her about that.
We have at times chosen the path of the grand gestures of construction rather than the real important gestures of human life. And it tells us that our priorities have been distorted and that we need to change quickly if we want the next generation to have hope. I mean, it is an awakening. I'd been to the upper reaches of this community. I'd never been down here.
Do you feel critical of yourself?
Yes. I just said to her, I apologize. It took me so long to get here. I'm not perfect. I don't claim to be perfect.
Wow. So Mayor Cruz taking the heat and the blame for past problems. But Jasmine, let's face it, her real anger sounds like it's really about the slow recovery response right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a widespread feeling across the island. A lot of anger at local and federal government.
Jasmine, thanks very much for telling us about San Juan's mayor. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
The World's Jasmine Garz reporting for our Crosswinds Lives desk. They've got stories from Puerto Rico all this week on the program. We'll hear how a Puerto Rican family here in Boston lost contact with their loved ones on the island after the hurricane, and will embark on a quest to get a letter to their 75-year-old grandmother on a remote part of Puerto Rico. A letter for Nereida starting tomorrow here on The World. Meanwhile, check out our team's reporting from Puerto Rico on Instagram. That's at Women's Lives. Large crowds demonstrated in Barcelona yesterday to demand that the region of Catalonia not secede from Spain. In some ways, the mirror image of the massive protests we've seen in Barcelona recently in favor of Catalan independence. The region held a referendum on independence on October 1st. Spain's central government called the vote illegal and even used force to try to shut it down. And this week, the Catalan government could be about to unilaterally declare independence. Through it all, the European Union has stayed mostly quiet, even though this is all happening in an EU member state. Stephen Erlanger is chief diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. So you've written this analysis of the EU's response to secession in Catalonia for The New York Times. And we saw Spanish police last week beating up people and firing rubber bullets, all to stop Catalans from voting. It was really surprising that the EU didn't say anything about this, or it didn't say much. What did you see in that lack of a response?
The European Union is fundamentally a club of democratic nations, but more importantly, of sovereign nations. and not of regions. Now, Spain is a sovereign nation. It's a big part of the European Union, fourth largest economy. The European Union has little to say, partly because Spain doesn't want it to say anything.
I mean, France has now come out and said it will not recognize Catalonia if the region unilaterally declares independence. Are you seeing other European countries kind of proactively saying the same thing?
Well, yes. And in fact, regionalism is such a sensitive topic that still, so many years after the Kosovo War, five of the 28 members of the European Union still do not recognize Kosovo as an independent country. So it's very sensitive. If it is Catalonia today in Spain, it could be the Basque Country again in Spain. It could be Corsica in France. It could be northern Italy. It could be Transylvania in Romania. There are lots of regions who have their own cultures and have their own histories who might want to be independent, but would create a great deal of unrest inside their own countries and hence inside the European Union itself. So the European Union is stuck. There have been lots of calls for it to mediate somehow in Spain, but as officials say to me, you can only mediate if both sides want you to mediate, and Spain wants us to keep our nose out of its internal affairs.
So you mentioned Corsica. There, of course, is Catalonia. I'm just curious, what's the reaction been in some parts of Europe to Europe's lack of a reaction? Because clearly there are some actors who like the idea of independence and secession for these territories.
Yes, but in general, there has been just a feeling that Europe has enough problems without having to deal with countries getting tinier and tinier, and enough economic problems. I mean, Spain has recovered pretty well from its big debt crisis and jobless crisis after 2008. And the uncertainty over Catalonia puts that at risk. And of course, if Catalonia did secede, was allowed to secede, it would no longer be a member of the European Union. It would no longer be able to use the euro currency. Its banks could collapse very quickly. It would be really a mess, and Spain would be damaged too, which would damage quite a lot of the other countries that have lent Spain money to support its recovery. So as much as people may sympathize for those people who were hit by the police, or as much as people may feel that Prime Minister Rajoy of Spain overreacted, they don't want to see civil war in Europe. They certainly don't want to see it inside the European Union, and they don't feel any great need for something else to destabilize a Europe that's finally growing again economically.
Stephen Erlanger, the chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, speaking with us from Brussels. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, more evidence that Russia was out to troll you, American voter, during last year's election. You're tuned to The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. First Facebook, then Twitter, and now Google. There's new evidence that Google was also the target of a Russian ad campaign to spread disinformation during the 2016 U.S. election. The company found nearly all its platforms were affected, including Gmail and YouTube. Elizabeth Dwoskin covers Silicon Valley for The Washington Post. She says Google's investigation is still in its early stages, but they found evidence of political ads linked to Russian currency and Russian IP addresses.
I think, and my sources think, that this is just the tip of the iceberg. We know, of course, that the intelligence community concluded in January that Russian President Vladimir Putin tried to interfere in the U.S. election to help Donald Trump. What we saw on Facebook was that Facebook found ads that were published and bought by the Internet Research Agency, which is a troll farm in Russia, that many tie to the Kremlin. But what's interesting about what Google found is that Google found ads that they believe to be connected to the Russian government, but they're not IRA ads. They're not tied to the Internet Research Agency. So we have another wrinkle where we're seeing interference that seems to be tied to the Kremlin, but to a different part of it. And these were political ads. So that's one fascinating question. And then the other question is, how does it relate to the way that targeted advertising works on the World Wide Web? You know, Google and Facebook are the biggest online advertising companies. And what we see is that the way that the targeting works online is it feeds into itself. So, for example, if you look at a pair of shoes online today, those shoes are going to follow you all over the internet, and they're going to follow you onto Facebook too.
Like a nightmare.
Right, like a nightmare. And it turns out it's very effective when you see the same thing over and over again to influence you. So this has been used by these companies to great effect in the last few years. The Russians realized that they could do this too. And so in a previous story, we showed how information that was being collected from your travels on the web was actually being used to turbocharge that targeting on Facebook and show it to you again and again and again. And what you see is this bigger picture of an influence campaign.
And when Google says it's looking for tens of thousands of dollars worth of ads, I mean, shouldn't that number kind of strike us as really low when it comes to advertising?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these are billion-dollar companies. Facebook's market cap is nearly $1 trillion. That's why I said I think that it's just the tip of the iceberg. And then the question is, how are they looking? Are they really looking across all of their websites and all the ad pixels that were on these websites? Are they really making the connections that outside researchers and advocates are starting to say are there?
I'm just curious to know, what is your sense of the contrition right now in Silicon Valley? Because in tandem with the Trump collusion, Russia investigation, is anyone really sincerely alarmed in the Bay Area about what these threats mean for future elections? Who's saying, hit pause and let's ensure that democracy is not going to get hacked next time around?
I think everyone's alarmed, but the question is, are they really willing to do the kind of stuff that would prevent these things from happening in the next election cycle? And can they do that without massively damaging their businesses? One of the reasons that online advertising is so lucrative and efficient is because so much of it is automated and self-served. So if you start adding a lot more humans into the process, you're going to slow it down. And that's going to affect how advertising works on the web. So I think to really change it and to really verify it, we're talking about a massive change in the system that I don't really think these companies appear to be ready to do. Now, remember, this Russian exploitation is one example, the latest and most nefarious, because it cuts to the core of our democracy itself. But there have been problems with verification, falseness, inflation of numbers. I mean, the online advertising world is kind of a wild west. And this shows how deep the consequences go when you can exploit it. But we've known that it's very exploitable.
Elizabeth Dwoskin covers Silicon Valley for The Washington Post. Now to another story about nefarious Russian activity online, this one with a different technology company at its center, Kaspersky Lab. It's a Moscow-based company, and they make antivirus and security software that's used by hundreds of millions of people around the world. Kaspersky Lab has long been suspected of having ties to the Kremlin. Now there's evidence that hackers working for the Russian government use the software to steal highly classified U.S. documents.
The documents concern the techniques and the methods that the National Security Agency uses to break into foreign computer systems and spy on American adversaries.
That's Shane Harris of the Wall Street Journal. He co-reported the story, which he says began back in 2015 when an NSA contractor put the highly classified documents on a flash drive.
So he took the information home, and we've been told that it was not malicious intent. He wanted to work on this information at home, which we should say is not allowed. And he loaded it onto his personal computer at his home. Now, that computer was running Kaspersky's antivirus software product, which is used to scan the machine for viruses and malicious software. And what intelligence officials believe is that in the course of that scanning, Kaspersky's software became aware of this sensitive information that was on the contractor's computer now. And at that point, Russian hackers kind of moved in, homed in on his machine, and were able to obtain that information.
How does the information gotten from Kaspersky software then kind of end up in Russia?
Yeah, this is sort of some key sequences that I think are still – they're certainly still a bit mysterious to us, and I think they are to investigators as well. But what they've concluded is that Kaspersky essentially acted like a scout, if you like, that went out and scanned the system to find out what was on it. And in that respect, it did work like any antivirus product is supposed to work. It makes it a log, essentially, of everything that's on your computer and compares it to a master list of potentially malicious files and viruses. How precisely the machine – after or the software, once it alerted to the presence of this information, then either notified people into Kaspersky who told the Russian government, or did the Russian government find a way to get into Kaspersky's software? That we still don't know, but intelligence officials have determined that if not for Kaspersky doing this scan, the hackers who ultimately compromised this contractor would not have known that he had this material on his computer.
So Kaspersky Lab has denied allegations that its software is being used to spy on the U.S. Has the company responded to your story in the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah, they have. They said they have no knowledge of the instance that's being described and that they do not participate in offensive operations of the one that is described in our article.
And what about the NSA? Have they confirmed this breach happened?
They have not confirmed that it happened. And what's very interesting is just last month, the U.S. government took the extraordinary step of banning all of its departments and agencies in the entire government from using Kaspersky's products. And the scenarios that they were worried about, that they spelled out in a public statement accompanying that ban, bear very close similarities to what happened here. So we think that this is kind of a case study in what the government has been fearing for many years about what Kaspersky can be used to do.
Why did it take 2 years for the federal government to ban its use?
That's a really good question. My best guess at this point, and we're still looking at that, is that it's such an extraordinary thing for the government to ban a commercial company in this way. Also, you know, in the intelligence business, sometimes even if you know something is a threat, you don't want to tip that publicly because you may not know want your adversary to know what you know or know what you suspect.
All right, Shane, what if you're not working in the intelligence arena, which most of us listening to you are not? And if we use Kaspersky antivirus software, should we be freaking out that we may be an unwitting Russian spy?
Well, look, there are many security experts who think this is a very good product. There are also many experts outside the U.S. government who have raised the same concerns that the United States has. I think a user needs to look at that and determine for themselves whether they think these are credible claims and whether they're comfortable using it.
Shane Harris there, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. There's a new wave of young female North Korean defectors, and they're becoming reality TV stars in Seoul.
Do you know who Beyoncé is?
Beyoncé 완전 섹시하지. Sexy, sexy, very sexy. I like her.
That story is coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. North Korea and its nuclear threats were on President Trump's mind over the weekend. He tweeted that only one thing will work when it comes to dealing with Pyongyang. What that means is not exactly clear, as often the case with Trump's tweets. So watch this space in the days ahead for more on that. In the meantime, here's another bit of news about North Korea. There is a new face in the country's top decision-making body, the Politburo. She is Kim Yo-jong, the younger sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and she's a rising star in his regime.
It is quite a meteoric rise. It has only taken her 3.5 years to reach a level that took her aunt 20 years to achieve.
That's Heejin Koo, a research fellow with the Korean Peninsula Future Forum based in South Korea. She says Kim Yo-jong is somewhere between 28 and 30. She's the youngest known daughter of North Korea's previous leader, Kim Jong-il. And because of that, she's mostly kept a low profile.
She first appeared at the side of her father just before his death. And we have seen footage and photographs of her since 2010. But she was only identified and officially recognized by the North Korean Politburo since 2013. She was named as the vice director of the Workers' Party Propaganda and Agitation Department.
In that job, she's been the architect of her brother's public image, helping to create a cult of personality around Kim Jong-un. Her promotion now to the Politburo signals her brother's continued trust, which is not something you take for granted in North Korea. Remember, since coming to power, Kim Jong-un has executed an uncle and reportedly had a half-brother killed. The fact that Kim Yo-jong is a woman is less significant, according to Hee Jin-koo.
If you look at the footage of the various Workers' Party plenary sessions, we do know that there are a vast number of men than women in the Congress. So Kim Yo-jong's meteoric rise is not a testament to the equality of men and women in North Korea. Kim Yo-jong's position has been achieved due to the fact that she is a sister to Kim Jong-un.
Hee Jin-koo there, a research fellow with the Korean Peninsula Future Forum in South Korea. She spoke with our colleagues at the BBC. Most North Koreans who defect to the South try to keep their head down, and for good reason. They're often discriminated against. Many South Koreans see them as backwards and possibly brainwashed. But a new set of North Korean refugees wants to defy that. They don't just want acceptance. They want to be stars in South Korea's flashy entertainment industry. The World's Patrick Nguyen met one of these celebrity defectors in Seoul.
This is what entertainment in South Korea sounds like. And up in North Korea, entertainment is produced exclusively by the state. It exalts the glories of the Kim dynasty. It stokes revolutionary fervor. It's hard to imagine anyone from that world becoming a hot celebrity in South Korea, home of the glitziest entertainment industry in all of Asia, maybe anywhere. But it's starting to happen.
안녕하세요. 저는 김아라라고 하고요.
That's Kim Ara, an actress who now lives in Seoul. She belongs to a new wave of celebrity defectors from North Korea. Kim is 25, dressed in leggings, full of effervescent energy. You'd never know she grew up during a famine, surviving on grass soup. Kim defected to South Korea in 2009. She and her mom escaped through an underground railroad run by Korean Christians. It's a long story, and the details are a bit sensitive. But Kim can talk about the place where she was born, a hilly province near the Chinese border. All of her early memories seem to revolve around food, or the lack of it. As a kid, she didn't go to school. She scrounged for herbs, bark, anything you could boil into a thin gruel.
We put one spoon of rice and also some other grasses, and then we put a lot of water. We pour a lot of water and we boil it together to make a porridge. It was really dark.
Kim's tales from back home are beyond bleak. She says her family once sold their entire house for 10 kilos of corn. Then there was the time she was so hungry she ate a pumpkin seed off the ground, later realizing it had passed through a dog. When Kim first got to South Korea, she kept these stories to herself. She says people would ask her insulting questions, like, well, if you were so hungry, why didn't you just eat some noodles?
I thought it's kind of mean and also it's twisted. That question came to me in a very big hurt because I already looked down on me myself.
Then this happened.
명예추장 칭호를 드렸다.
A hit talk show with a unique premise, Northern Beauties, talking openly about life in North Korea. The show debuted in 2012. Suddenly, lots of things North Koreans kept hidden were being discussed openly on TV by glamorous young defectors. Kim was in beauty school at the time, and she was instantly hooked. Then, one day, she was scouted and asked to come on the show. She could not believe it.
When I entered the studio for the first time, it was so super bright. And also, there were 50 cameras in front of me. And I was so embarrassed. I was so nervous in there.
But eventually, Kim became a regular. Soon they had her on the show reading North Korean propaganda messages to amuse the studio audience. Like other young defectors, Kim used the show as a springboard to better gigs. Many have joined reality shows that pair up South Koreans and defectors and force them to do silly challenges together. It's kind of a thing now. But Kim prefers dramas. In one of her latest roles, she plays a North Korean woman on a date with a handsome South Korean guy. They're eating from a bubbling pot of chicken. The guy asks gingerly, "So, do you eat chicken feet?" Her response is, the feet. Come on, I eat the head, that fleshy thing under its beak, even the eyes. They're delicious. Kim gets excited when I bring this up. Hey, she says, I actually wrote some of that dialogue.
Actually, I make the line. It's my lines. I wanted to show the woman who doesn't have fear or the woman who is strong because that's the personality of the North Korean woman.
Here's the thing. These new defector shows, they don't often emphasize female strength. They're obsessed with young, attractive women, often portraying them as meek and pure of heart. I bring this up to a sociologist who studied these programs, Park Yun-soon from Ewha Women's University in Seoul.
북한 여성의 아주 전형적인 남한에서 비치는 모습이라고 하는 것은
She says these shows are feeding a stereotype of a North Korean feminine ideal, pretty, demure, so sheltered by the regime that they're kind of lovably naive. The worst, she says, are reality shows that pair young, giggling defectors in simulated marriages with rich South Korean guys. Here's one where an aging baseball player tries to teach his young North Korean TV bride how to high-five. She gets confused. Plus, she's delicate. So she flinches in pain. Professor Park thinks these shows are turning refugees into a fantasy, a fetish, and that they appeal to guys turned off by the new generation of vocal, assertive South Korean women. I run some of this by Kim, and she says, yeah, it's kind of true. The shows don't always project North Korean women as strong.
Do you think that you're a brave or tough person? Because escaping from North Korea is about as brave and tough as it gets.
Of course. I'm brave a lot. I'm very brave. The North Korean women are normally, they're very strong because they have to be.
I ask Kim if there's a Korean female celebrity who she really admires, someone who's widely loved but also fiercely independent. She can't really think of anyone, so I try an example from my own country.
Do you know who Beyoncé is?
Beyoncé 완전 섹시하지. Sexy, sexy, very sexy. I like her. Single lady.
What do you like about her?
Body. Body.
Her hot, sexy body. And also, when she sings a song, she looks really powerful.
Like Beyoncé, Kim also wants to advance a social and political message. Don't view North Koreans as pathetic or weak, she says. Try to listen and learn something from their experiences instead of just gawking. My last question for Kim may sound benign, but it's actually a bit touchy. See, defectors are expected to condemn everything about North Korea, lest someone think they're still brainwashed. But I just have to know, is there anything she misses about North Korea?
있죠. 그 이제 봄이라던가 이럴 때
Actually, yes, she says, and returns once again to a memory of food.
The plum, the white plum. I think that's the fruit only can be raised in the northern part. So the taste of the white plum, I never forget it. I really want to have it once more. And the villagers, at night, we all gathered in front of a small fire, and then we play together and we sing a song together. Those moments I will never forget.
For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Seoul, South Korea.
Personal question, are you inked? In many parts of the world, getting tattooed is a classic sign of independence, the perfect teenage rebellion. But in some parts of India, the true act of rebellion for young women is not to get a tattoo. My BBC colleague Geeta Pandey has been exploring why teenagers in India are refusing to get inked. How popular are tattoos in India, just kind of generally, Geeta?
Traditionally, what we've had, you know, in lots of communities, rural communities and lots of tribal areas, it was tradition to get tattoos. But of course, you know, that was dictated by tradition or, you know, certain kind of cultural identity. And that is something that's very different from, you know, what people do now for fashion.
Right. So we're talking traditional tattoos, and we're talking specifically women who have traditionally gotten them and are now refusing. So what do these traditional tattoos symbolize for women?
The reason why I started researching tattoos was because, you know, my mother has a couple of tattoos. Now, my mother is 84 years old, and she got tattoos when she got married. So literally, she was forced to get tattoos. And she was told that if she did not have a tattoo, she would not be considered pure. And in her matrimonial home, nobody would drink water that she would touch or, you know, food that she would offer. So, you know, it was essential for married women to have tattoos. And that was something that, you know, I kind of rebelled against because, you know, in my family, it was essential. It was necessary the moment you got married to have a tattoo.
What kind of designs do we see in these traditional tattoos, especially for women?
Well, there were like, you know, all kinds of tattoos. A lot of the women get flowers and, you know, basically flora and fauna, but also the names of their husbands, their fathers, the names of their village, or sometimes a local god or a deity or some very popular, important person from the community.
It sounded, as you were speaking earlier, that a lot of this is wrapped up in superstition. Why do younger women in India see not getting inked as a sign of rebellion? Can you explain that?
Yes, a lot of the younger women now, in fact, even sort of in some of the tribal areas, women are refusing to get tattoos because one of the reasons, of course, is, you know, because how painful it is. You know, you're still talking about women getting tattoos in the traditional way, right? That means there's no anesthetic. The healing process is very long and it's very painful. So they are refusing to get tattoos because it make them stand out, make them look backward. It make them look not nice, and they are painful. So they are refusing to get tattoos.
I mean, it sounds like there are legitimate health risks and also some style considerations. Do you really see the trend of not getting inked for young women a feminist statement?
Well, I think it definitely is a feminist statement in certain ways, right? Women are getting more conscious of their rights because there was also an explanation which said that, you know, they are given these tattoos because before they have their children, it prepares them for the pain of the childbirth. And, you know, a lot of the young women are rejecting that notion. A lot of the young women are saying that, no, you know, that's not what we are going to, you know, subscribe to. These are outdated ideas. We don't really need them. And I definitely see it as a feminist statement.
If these traditional tattoos were to just disappear, I mean, wouldn't certain communities lose some aspects of their identity and tradition?
That's definitely maybe one way of looking at it, right? I think a lot of the women in these communities would ask, right? I mean, you know, why only men, right? I mean, if you really want to preserve your tradition, why not just start tattooing men, right? I mean, you know, because that's a question I always asked my mother. How come dad never had any tattoos? And she said, oh, because he was pure enough, right? I mean, he was a boy, he was a man. So, you know, I think, you know, these ideas need to be dismantled that, you know, women are impure and men are pure. So, you know, I think I have a problem with that. And I think a lot of these women are challenging that notion too. It doesn't necessarily have to be that, you know, to carry forward your cultural heritage, you have to torture women.
My BBC colleague, Geeta Pandey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
We've been focusing a lot on Puerto Rico since Hurricanes Irma and Maria struck there last month. But Puerto Rico wasn't the only place to receive that double whammy. And some of you asked us to check in on another U.S. territory that was devastated by the storms, the U.S. Virgin Islands. For an update, we called up Shalana Brown, a reporter with TV2 News on St. Croix.
Our main needs right now is assistance with communication and, of course, power restoration. We have a number of individuals that had to be sent away because they have certain illnesses and they need power in order to survive. But I wouldn't say that we are starving or anything. We may not have the foods we would like. And I would dare to say, too, of course, roofing issues for individuals who have lost their roof. Now, it's raining a lot. And so if you have lost pieces of your roof and may not have received any tarping as yet, that may be a really big issue in the territory as well.
And those people you mentioned who did not get tarps and their houses are ruined, where are they staying?
Well, I suspect that most people are staying still in their homes. I've visited a number of communities, I would say low-income homes, and they don't have anywhere to go, and they're living in homes that have black mold. And I've seen this firsthand.
Sorry, say that again. Homes that have black what?
Black mold.
Black mold, yeah, very common.
Mold growing, because there's elderly people there, and a lot of mothers with children living in those communities. And they're staying there because they really don't have anywhere else to go. Because, quite frankly, we're surrounded by water and we can't just go to another state. So we just have to do what we have.
What is the food situation currently in the U.S. Virgin Islands?
The food situation, we have, as you know, Tim Duncan, who is a Virgin Islander.
Tim Duncan, the basketball star.
Yes, correct. He has a relief fund, and I was in the line myself yesterday. And today and yesterday, he was giving out canned food. We don't necessarily, may not get what we like, but I wouldn't say anyone is starving. I am a little concerned about the canned food and its long-term results on the people of the Virgin Islands in terms of health.
Shalana Brown of TV2 on the U.S. Virgin Island of St. Croix. Thank you very much. And you should know that we've been hearing from lots of people who are thinking about the U.S. Virgin Islands. So know that you are not forgotten.
I appreciate you hearing our story.
We often take you out with music. Today, it's music that connects to this particular day. Wayne Newell and his son Chris Newell, they're Passamaquoddy, members of the indigenous Wabanaki Confederacy in the state of Maine. And for all of their communities, Welcome Song would be sung when visitors arrived in their territory. The song will be featured in a new documentary, Dawnland. The film is not about music, but getting the music right in it is crucial. The documentary follows the stories of several key players involved in the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC. They've tracked from 1978 to now the various and disturbing ways Native children have been systemically separated from their families. It's resulted in what many Native people describe as an ongoing genocide. Chris Newell, the singer we heard a moment ago, is on the Dawnland team, making sure the film accurately represents the culture of the Wabanaki people, and it's not easy.
Some of these musics come from 400 to 500 years and even older than that. Some of the language that's included, we can't even properly translate into English because we don't speak that version of Passamaquoddy anymore.
So what is your assessment, Chris, of how culture over time has represented Native communities, specifically the Wabanaki, through film and music?
All right. Well, when it comes to the way, Native cultures have been presented in film over time, of course, it's been, you know, somewhat of a tenuous journey in that, you know, the early days of it were often produced by non-Native producers, and they were their impressions of what our culture should be, rather than having so much of the outside influence, presenting how they see us. So we're trying to really take over this narrative now of how we present ourselves, because some of the stories of the folks that were taken, the things that happened to them, sometimes so tragic that they felt and they were treated as if, you know, these stories were unbelievable.
According to a 2013 study, Native children nationwide are twice as likely as non-Native children to be taken from their families and put into foster care. An earlier report from the 1970s found that Native children in Maine were 19 times more likely. Dawn Land follows this devastating truth.
So when it came to the vision for the music for the film, I wanted to really reflect the voice of the communities through music. Music is one of the things that has spoken and kept our story alive through all of these years. So when it's created by us, for the purposes of, you know, whatever purposes, whether it's ceremonial or dance or just to make you happy or maybe to settle somebody who's going through a hard time at a funeral or something like that. That's what I consider, real Wabanaki music. And that's one of the reasons why we're producing a lot of this Native-produced media with this idea in mind of telling our story from our perspective.
Chris Newell, head of education at the Pequot Museum, speaking with us from Mashantucket, Connecticut. Thank you very much for your time. Great to meet you, Chris.
All right. Thank you.
Lauren Stevens, as a little girl, sang at Native ceremonies and gatherings. This is Lauren singing Humbling Song for Dawnland. A little something to consider on this, what some call Columbus Day and others call Indigenous Peoples Day. The hurricanes we were talking about earlier on the show, Maria and Irma, they've reminded us about the history that brought us a holiday on this day and the colonial oppression of another Indigenous group, the Taino. They were living on the islands of Puerto Rico and Hispaniola before Columbus arrived. The Taino had a belief system that, interestingly, in this moment of serious post-hurricane deprivation, elevated deities of food and fresh water. More food for thought as the modern inhabitants of the Caribbean cope with the ravages of nature and man-made climate change. That's where we'll leave things today, however you want to call this holiday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow is definitely Tuesday. We'll see you back here then.
PRI, Public Radio International.